And so we reach the last day of Ancestor Appreciation Week. There's national holidays of Mother's Day and Father's Day, but at Warm Jewel Temple we have annual Ancestor Appreciation Week. Just as our blood ancestors, parents and grandparents, give us our life, we wouldn't be here without them. In the spiritual world, our Zen ancestors give us our life, and we truly wouldn't be here without the Buddhas and ancestors. Revering Buddhas and ancestors, we are one Buddha and one ancestor. I think it took me some years of practice to warm up to that, a deep gratitude for these ancestors and really appreciating that we truly wouldn't be here, right? This Zen Center wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be in Sesshin. And though there may be debate about the historical accuracy of that, the ancient part of the lineage, some of these Indian ancestors, we maybe are not so sure about. But we know that it had to be, these teachings had to be passed on face to face, warm hand to warm hand, by human beings to each other. It had to be such a way. I don't think there was ever a link in the lineage where someone never met another practitioner and just read it in a book. We need the living connection. And even historically, I'm quite confident that from around the time of the sixth ancestor of Zen in China, is around the 7th century, up to today, that those ancestors, however they lived and practiced, those names really did have these intimate relationships with each other. The history was recorded, you know, at beginning around that time. And it seems like it is so. We don't know exactly how their practice was, but I think they were devoted to the way of freedom and compassion. And so these very early ancestors, you know, some of the middle ages of the Indian ancestors, maybe somewhat obscured in the mists of time, but we surely know many stories about Shakyamuni Buddha, Mahakashyapa, and Ananda. Ananda was another Buddha's disciples, and Ananda, the second ancestor, was the Venerable Ananda. He asked Venerable Kashyapa, "Elder Dharma brother, did the world honored one transmit anything else to you besides the gold brocade robe?" Kashyapa called, "Ananda." Ananda replied, and Kashyapa said, "Knock down the flagpole in front of the gate." And Ananda was greatly awakened. This is Ananda's awakening. We'll come back to this story in a little bit. But first, Kazan has some stories about Ananda's life. He was from Rajagriha and came from a Kshatriya family, the warrior caste in India. His father was King Dronodana. Actually, Ananda was the World Honored One's cousin. I think it was the Buddha's father's brother's son, Ananda, so like blood cousin. In Sanskrit, his name was Ananda, which in our country means joy. He was born on the night that Tathagata achieved the way. I think the Pali Canon says he was born the same day as the Buddha. He was respectable and handsome in appearance, and no one in the 16 great kingdoms of India was his equal. Everyone who saw him was filled with joy, hence his name. He was foremost of those who had heard much of the Buddha's teaching, and he was wise with vast learning. He was the Buddha's attendant. In Japanese we say jisha. For 20 years, and proclaimed everything the Buddha taught, and he studied the Buddha's deportment. At the same time, the World Honored One entrusted the treasury of the true Dharma eye to Kashyapa. He likewise entrusted it to Ananda, saying, "Help transmit it, Ananda." For this reason, he also followed Kashyapa for 20 years and cannot at all be said to have not understood the treasury of the true Dharma eye. Kazan says, "This should be evidence that the way of the ancestral teachers is not the same as that of other traditions outside Zen. Since Ananda was foremost among those who had heard much and had vast learning, the Buddha must have personally approved him greatly. However, he still did not transmit the true Dharma, nor did he open up and clarify the mind ground. When Kashyapa was assembling the teachings left by the Buddha after the Buddha passed from this world, at a meeting at the Vipula cave, since Ananda had not yet verified the fruit," they put in parentheses, "of arhatship, he could not enter the room. He was not allowed to enter. At that time, Ananda intimately meditated and promptly realized the fruit of arhatship." So Kazan tells this story, and this is also a story in the Pali Canon, that it's this first Buddhist council after the Buddha died. People kind of, all these Buddhist disciples were like, "Wow, we got, something's going here, and now the Buddha's gone, so we have to preserve these teachings." And the Sanghas, Buddha was kind of like the organizer of the Sangha, and now we have to get it together and keep it organized, and especially the teachings. So that's what this council, the first council, was held in this cave. I remember when we were, after we visited Vulture Peak in India, we went down for lunch in Rajagriha, and I think, was it Shoho and Yarrow?
No.
Rosemary. We were having lunch, and these two wise ones decided to skip lunch because I think a bunch of us got sick after this curry of Rajagriha. Do you remember this? A couple of them, let's go up to that cave where they held the first council, but I think it was a long hike. Maybe never made it to the top.
What was the place that we went to the Buddha's council? What was the first one? Was it the little town? Was it, we're talking about the same place, the little outside tent area we were eating?
Yeah.
Oh, that place,
right? Yeah, and there was a cave that just, we didn't all go to, but there's this cave up way up the hill where supposedly this first council happened. And I've been to it on a previous visit, so it's pretty big. You could imagine hundreds of people, big overhang, really, to where they gathered to compile the monastic precepts and compile all the teachings of the Buddha. and it was Mahakashyapa was kind of convening this assembly of 500 arhats. Remember, the arhats are like in early Buddhism, those who've realized nirvana. But according to the Mahayana, in a somewhat limited way. It's kind of a high standard for this meeting, like only arhats allowed in the meeting. So the problem was that Ananda wasn't an arhat. You know, he hadn't verified this fruit of no self. He hadn't fully realized this, the full range of this nirvanic freedom of the unconditioned Buddha mind. And this was a problem because Ananda, as you may know, was the one who knew all the teachings. He was the Buddha's attendant for 20 years, so he was at every Dharma talk. There's even some stories about when the Buddha was first asked to be the jisha, the attendant for the Buddha. The Buddha invited him, and Ananda, bold as he was, said, "I'll only be your attendant on several conditions." Some of the conditions are basically, as long as I don't get any special privileges for being your attendant, like, I don't want any perks of this for this job, because otherwise, people will claim that I just want to be your attendant for fame and profit, and actually I don't. So, for my own training, I want to make sure I don't take advantage of being the Buddha's attendant. So, no special privileges, please. Like, if you get some really nice meal offering, Buddha, I request that you don't share it with me, unless you share it with everybody. So it's beautiful practice, I think. And then the other side was kind of for himself. He said, "I request also that if I'm your attendant, that I can attend all your talks, and I can ask if I have any doubts about the practice. I can ask at any time." And if anybody wants to come see you, since I keep the Dokusan list as the Jisha, that you won't turn anyone away. I request permission to let everyone see you. And this is the big one, I think. I request that if for some reason you ever give a spontaneous talk when I'm not around, even though I try to follow you everywhere, like if I'm in the toilet when you give a short talk or something, I request that you repeat it for me. Because I want to hear every teaching of the Buddha. And also, not just for myself, but maybe he had this intuition, somebody's got to, record all of this and make sure that it gets preserved for later generations. Thank you very much, Ananda, for your requests that the Buddha granted. So he heard all these teachings and practiced diligently, but it was the night before this first council, and everyone was concerned because the 499 arhats were all like, "We really need Ananda to be here because he's heard every Dharma talk, but we're not willing to lower our standard. we really need him to be an arhat." And Ananda knew this too, and he's like, "For the sake of everyone, including those who have later practiced at Santa Cruz Zen Center and all these people, I really like, this is important." Yeah, can you imagine the pressure on this poor guy?
The fact that it's 499, that sounds like a big number to me.
It is, yeah. Sometimes they actually even say like there were 1,250 arhats. And I think this is what they say, is that when the Buddha was the Buddha, and so he was able to convey the Dharma just like incredibly skillfully, and all these people had this great awakening.
It wasn't the age of decline yet.
And it wasn't the age of decline. Yeah, I mean, that's how the story goes, that in the time when a Buddha's alive, it's like, you know, Bibashi Butsu, there were 6 million arhat disciples, right? Kind of amazing to think about that. These days, they say, like, in Theravada countries where arhat's like the goal of the practice in a way, there's, you know, whisperings and rumors spreading about who's an arhat. I think there's like in Thailand, where there's thousands and thousands of wholehearted practitioners, I think it's sort of considered like there's just a few maybe living arhats at any one time. But there are some.
I think it's just like the Theravada, that it's not a custom, a valid manner of custom, and if you want to claim any. I mean, it's also denial if you want to claim whatever. So you would never know.
Yeah, you're not allowed to say if you are an arhat, according to the monastic rules themselves, really, right?
That's the danger.
And maybe they're teachers, right? In Zen, it's a lot about that relationship is so important. I think that's part of the Mahayana, whereas in these countries, it may be they're like self-awakened, and sometimes they're like living as hermits. But there are the Buddha left some ways to check. To kind of check yourself in these early teachings. Again, this is all like before the Mahayana Buddha mind seal was transmitted. But just even stream entry, which is like a stage prior to arhat, but a definitive, irreversible insight that the Buddha left in teaching, is like, somebody asked him, like, how can I know if I've entered the stream? And it's quite beautiful. The Buddha's like, here's the checkpoints. The stream enter they have no more view of the independent self in a kind of experiential way. They know that there's this body and mind experience happening, but there's nobody at the core, and they've kind of verified that for themselves. And they also have no doubt about the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Like a doubt about the Buddha would be like, well, maybe the Buddha wasn't really like completely had all suffering had ceased for the Buddha. Maybe that's just a story to encourage us. No, there's no doubt. I understand how that could be possible, and that the Buddha realized this, and no doubt about the Buddha's Dharma, and no doubt about this Sangha and the practice.
Yeah, the engaging rituals for the ritual's sake anymore.
They don't think that rituals will be the cause of awakening. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the innate and imputed create a delusion, and they cut through the imputed. So they don't have any anger, you know, desire.
And interestingly, in this, when Buddha's giving this checklist too, he also brings in an ethical side. He said that I think this is just for the stream enterers are no longer capable of going against like 5 basic precepts, and we might say, you know, what is going against or, you know, breaking? How literal do we interpret this? But I think the point is that when they've seen that there's no self, they're not going to cause major harm anymore, intentional harm to living beings. I think that's a beautiful part. So we might say, when there's various ethical scandals, but somebody has a really deep insight into the nature of reality, but they're actually causing a lot of harm in the world, that according to the Buddha, be like, that, they don't, then they don't really understand. Mm-hmm. I think this is a nice point. So, when the date, this is the story about Ananda now before the council, the date was set for this council, it came, was coming closer, and Venerable Anuruddha suggested that Ananda only be admitted if he could overcome these last outflows and realize arhatship. Anuruddha knew the power of such an incentive, and it had the intended effect. When Ananda heard this stern stipulation, he decided to apply every bit of strength he had to realize nirvana. He practiced the four foundations of mindfulness throughout the night, sitting and walking, sitting and walking, sitting and walking. Sound familiar? In the early hours of the morning, as he was preparing to lie down after a full night of striving, just when he had raised his legs off the ground but had not yet laid his head on the pillow, his mind was released from all the outflows and delusions. I think the way my teacher has told the story is like, as he was diving into his bed, I forget it, I'm done, and I'm too tired to go on. He dove towards his bed, and as he was flying through the air, he realized arhatship. This is, as his legs left, after his legs left the floor, but before his head hit the pillow. So I think that's a great, almost like Zen-like story, actually, right? Because he was striving all night with great effort, and in the end he's like, enough, okay, whatever, I'm going to sleep now, I'm totally let go. Now I just give up, release all effort, and that's the moment. Relax completely, and the fruit is realized. What a great ancient story.
Was it just Zazen and
Kinyin? Zazen and Kinyin. Zazen and Kinyin.
And diving.
And diving, and then... Yeah, well, I think that's the thing. I kind of hear it as maybe he gave up hope. His striving is kind of, I gotta get it, I gotta get it. The morning's coming and the council's going to begin in an hour. And just like right to that point of total exertion and exhaustion, just like, oh, forget it. I surrender, I give up. And giving up is like dropping away the self. So, Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's right. It reminds me of a story of a modern day Zen teacher, Sung San Sunim, a Korean teacher who came to America and spread his teaching widely, and wonderful teacher. I guess I maybe met him once before he died. But he tells the story of him self-practicing in Korea, really, really, you know, hearing about this awakening, and like, I can't go on if I don't realize this. This is so, what's the point of living without this freedom? He really had this kind of energy, and he was just like up in the mountains by himself through, I think it was like a chanting retreat. He was just chanting Buddha's name, over and over again for a month or something, and he made this resolve that, like, if the resolve was something like, if I don't realize the way at the end of this month-long retreat, by the end, I'll take my own life. I can't go on living in the illusion of samsara anymore. So he made this resolve, and it was, again, like, the last night of the retreat, right? And he hadn't realized this. And I think it was something like the, you know, as dawn rose in the last hour, he had this great awakening, actually. So, yeah, something about setting it up. Yeah.
It reminds me of a scene from the last Batman movie that came out most recently with Christian Bale. And so there was a scene where he's escaping, his character is escaping from prison, right? And his prison is down like several hundred feet in this big hole. And in order to get up and out, you had to make this tremendous leap from one rocky level towards the top to like the edge of the precipice to finally escape. And so everyone who tried to escape tethered themselves to a rope so that if they missed the jump, they'd be saved by the rope and they wouldn't fall to death. And he missed several times. And it wasn't until the last time where he had no rope to tether himself, where his life was on the line.
Mm-hmm.
And he made the jump. And, you know, it was
interesting. And maybe also, I don't know, but maybe he felt like that little bit of extra weight of that rope just pulled him down from the ledge, and like we need to, you know, that last bit that holds us down, and can we let go of that?
Yeah.
Leap beyond. Yeah. Batman. It wasn't Batman. Was it Batman himself or another character?
At the time, he was becoming
Batman. So the Bodhisattva before realizing Batmanship.
He has a cape.
Well, and then this is the story sounds a little bit like Batman here too, actually, because so Ananda had this realization, and then the council was happening, but when he was about to enter the cave, Kashyapa said, well, if you've realized this fruit of arahatship, please enter, show it to us by entering the cave, by exhibiting paranormal power. So Ananda made himself very small and entered the room through the keyhole.
Yep.
How many people are coming
on? Oh.
They all can go through the keyhole.
Yeah, right.
Forget the door, you know.
I think commentaries say, you know, arhats don't necessarily have to have these special powers, but they often come along with the territory. The disciples said, Ananda has heard much as the Buddha's assistant, and his learning is extensive. Just as water is passed from one container to another without a drop being spilled, so Ananda possesses all the Buddha's teachings. We pray that you will ask Ananda to repeat the teachings. Kashyapa said to Ananda, the monks choose you, so ascend your seat and repeat what the Buddha said. At that time, Ananda had intimately protected the Buddha's entrustment within him. Receiving this request from Kashyapa, he stood, bowed at the feet of the assembled monks, and ascended the seat where he proclaimed, thus have I heard, once the Blessed One was living at... dot, dot, dot. Which is the way that all the sutras begin. And you know that one where they say, thus have I heard, that's Ananda's words, because he heard all of them. He gradually repeated all the sacred teachings of the Buddha's lifetime. Kashyapa asked the disciples, is this different from what the Tathagata taught? And the disciples said, it does not differ by as much as a word from what the Tathagata taught. The disciples were great arhats who possessed the three kinds of spiritual knowledge and the six special powers, and they did not miss hearing anything, which are these knowledges and powers are remembering past lives and the celestial eye that sees the karmic cause and effect of all other beings and their past lives, and clairvoyance, clairaudience, reading others' minds, and also the cessation of all greed, hate, and delusion, which is the important one. With one voice, they all said, "We don't know whether the Tathagata has returned or whether this was spoken by Ananda." They praised him, saying, "The great ocean of Buddha Dharma has flowed into Ananda. What Ananda has spoken is the flowing right now of what the Tathagata has spoken." Kazan says, "We understand that this is evidence that this way does not rely on much hearing or on realizing the fruit of arhatship. Moreover, for 20 years, Ananda followed Kashyapa and was greatly awakened for the first time on the occasion of this story." So he's saying he realized arhatship before the council, but then later he practiced with Mahakashyapa and they had this dialogue where he realized the Buddha mind seal of the ancestors, different from arhatship, and in a very simple way, without any striving all night even, in this story. Since Ananda was born on the night that Tathagata achieved the way, he had not heard the Avatamsaka Sutra or other sutras spoken right after the Buddha's enlightenment. Still, he acquired the samadhi of the perfect knowledge of a Buddha and proclaimed what he had never heard. So, the Avatamsaka Sutra, spoken under the Bodhi tree, begins, "Thus have I heard." So Ananda's like, kind of like channeling it from the past. That was how Ananda was. He could speak even what he had never heard. However, as for not entering the way of the ancestral teachers of Zen, his inability was the same as our not entering, it says in parentheses, when we rely on erudition and intellectual understanding. So this is the point here is that the disciples and arhats like Ananda could hear all these, especially Ananda, he listened to all these teachings, but he hadn't really realized them himself. Like his sutras sometimes say, like hearing about others' riches but not having a penny of one's own. So it is important though to hear the Buddha's teachings, right? So it makes me think of these three types of wisdom, the wisdom from hearing the Buddha's teachings. It's a kind of wisdom. And I think Ananda had that. He understood what the Buddha meant by these teachings. And then there's the wisdom from reflection, like applying these teachings to one's own experience, still in a conceptual way. And maybe Ananda did that too. And then there's the third, wisdom of becoming, or the wisdom through cultivation, where one completely internalizes the teachings and realizes them directly oneself. So that's an early Buddhist teaching, these three types of wisdom. And they usually say that the wisdom of becoming the teachings, or the wisdom through actually cultivating them, relies on the first two types. Like, we need to hear the teachings, we need a conceptual understanding, and we need to reflect on them again and again, applying them to our lives first. So, and I think even Zen ancestors might agree with this. It's just that the wisdom through hearing in Zen takes this funny form sometimes of like these strange Zen stories. But I think the point being that we need to study Dharma, but we really need to apply it to our own lives and practice. So now I'm going to skip several pages here because there's a lot of extra stories we don't have time to go through. After Ananda realized great enlightenment, he proclaimed the teachings again. It was like fire uniting with fire. Clearly, if you want to clarify the true way, abandon the false view of self old emotions, pride, and self-importance. Turn your beginner's mind to realizing Buddha knowledge. With regard to this present story, Ananda thought that the transmission of the gold cloth robe to Kashyapa meant that outside of being a disciple of the Buddha, symbolized by the robe, there was nothing else to be transmitted. So this is now, we're going back to the original story now, which is that Ananda asked Kashyapa, "Elder Dharma brother, did the world honored one transmit anything else to you besides this gold brocade robe?" And Kashyapa called, "Ananda." Ananda responded, "Yes." Kashyapa said, "Knock down the flagpole in front of the gate." And Ananda was awakened. So first Ananda's asking, "Did the Buddha transmit anything else to you besides the gold brocade robe?" And we're skipping over. Kazan has all these stories about the robe, like that the sixth ancestor, Huainun, received the robe of Bodhidharma, which was a blue-black cotton robe, which is like that one. So in Zen, the great sixth ancestor, according to this, had a bluish-black robe. And then I think this issue of the robe that gets passed along, that's all a big symbol in Zen, I think it's interesting that in the Pali Canon, long before Zen, there is this story that just after Mahakashyapa's ordination, which we heard in the previous story when the Buddha said, "Come, welcome, monk," and that was Mahakashyapa's ordination. Then they walked side by side, the Buddha and Mahakashyapa, back to the village, and on their way they stopped to rest, and Mahakashyapa laid out his robe, his square okesa that people still in Southeast Asia, they sometimes use these for like blankets and sit on, and it's very practical. He laid it on the ground for the Buddha to sit on, and the Buddha sat on it and said, "Wow, your okesa is very soft and comfy." It was like a plush okesa. And No, actually it was the okesa. They said they folded it into four panels, and sometimes I guess they would actually sit on that because it's bigger than a zagu. But sitting cloth also they sometimes sat on. In this case it was the kesa, which that's what this story says, the gold brocade kesa, which is Japanese for kashaya, which means broken color. Literally, the robe is called broken or mixed color, means like it's not a bright, fancy, special color. More like it's just it's the mix of all colors. So, meant to be something that's just very ordinary.
Is it meant to be? I know in some traditions they find rags.
Yeah, so that's...
To do their...
Yeah, yeah. And so the Buddha had a rag robe, and we don't know what kind Mahakashyapa had at this point, but it was soft. But the Buddha had this rag robe that...
Yeah, he just appeared on
his... Yeah, you remember that part. It appeared on his body. So according to that story, which is not in the Pali Canon, so... whatever it was some nicer robe than the Buddha's. And the Buddha, there's all these stories that Kazan says, well, where did this Buddha's robe come from? And that I think the one legend from the early sutras is like when the Buddha first left home, right, he was still in all his princely garb, and he he's like, I shouldn't be like a wandering yogi dressed like a prince. I need something more simple. So he met this hunter, like the first person he met out in the woods, and the hunter had kind of ragged robe. He said, you want to trade? And the hunter was like, sure, I'll take the prince robes.
By the way, in the movie, Bruce Wayne, the comes across like a homeless guy, and they exchange clothes, and he puts on a coat, and he gives like nice clothes to a homeless guy.
Wow. Maybe they knew about this story.
Yeah. Was that the first one? Was that take place like in Nepal or something like that?
That was the first one. Yep. Yeah.
Add one more.
Batman is from Nepal.
Well, in that story, he came about in Nepal.
Anyway. So, yeah.
Interesting. I have to go back and watch this.
And guess what's coming? This is the latest version of time. Virtual reality.
Ah, virtual reality.
I've known that long.
Batman, special powers. He was a bodhisattva, I think, too, right? Batman just was lived to help others. So, another story is that Mahaprajapati, maybe this was in the Mahayana Sutras, Mahaprajapati made a gold brocade robe and gave it to the Buddha. But at any rate, Buddha had, in the Pali canon, Buddha had this rag robe, and when he sat on Kashyapa's robe, he said, "This is a soft robe." And Kashyapa said, "Well, if you'd like it, would you take it?" And the Buddha said, "Well, you probably wouldn't like to wear this old rag robe, would you?" And Kashyapa said, "I'd be totally honored to, Blessed One." So they traded robes in the Pali canon. So that old story, and they say that that's the only time the Buddha ever gave his robe to somebody else. So that might be the origin of this Zen thing of like passing on the robe, because Mahakashyapa was the one who received the Buddha's. So Ananda asked, was there anything besides this that the Buddha transmitted? Kind of like saying, this is the outer symbol, what's the inner meaning? And then, however, after following Kashyapa and taking care of him so intimately, Ananda thought something must be communicated besides this. Kashyapa, knowing the time was ripe, called, "Ananda," and like an echo following a sound, Ananda responded, "Yes?" Like an echo following a sound. And literally it says, the characters are like a valley spirit. So it may be that in China, that's the way that's what they call an echo, is a valley spirit. That's just their colloquial name for literally like an echo in a valley is like, oh, that's the sound of the valley spirit, you know, repeating back, calling back. So either way, like an echo following a sound, Ananda responded, or like a valley spirit following a sound. It was like spark flying from a piece of flint. And so we could hear it as Ananda's like, well, there's this outer form of this robe, but was there something else behind it? Or like, this is a symbol, what's the symbol? And then when the Buddhist Mahakashyapa says, Ananda, that's like the outer form, that's his name, that's his identity. Ananda, he's calling him, but he's calling his inner spirit, right? He's calling the host with the outer form. So Ananda asks, well, this outer form was transmitted. What's the inner meaning behind it? And Kashyapa says, Ananda, calling his outer form to reach the inner host. And Kazan says, though Kashyapa called Ananda, he was not calling Ananda. And the response was not an answer. So we could hear it like that. Ananda, but he's not calling Ananda the person. He's calling the host. The name is a sign for the signless host, just like when we do the robe chant to honor the form of the robe in the morning, we say, great robe of liberation. Fieldless, field far beyond form and emptiness, literally the fuku dene means signless field of blessings. So it's the outer form of a piece of cloth represents this signless field of blessings. We wear the signless field of blessings. We wear the field beyond form and emptiness. We wear the host. The host within the outer host. And this call and response, which is like, in a way, we could say, putting aside the flagpole, knocking down a flagpole, we could say this was their meeting, actually. Just Ananda, yes? That was the actual, what did the Buddha transmit to you besides this robe? Ananda, yes? This was transmitted. Ananda, yes. Just immediate, natural, uncontrived response, open and ready. Like, there's many stories in Zen about this call and immediate response. One of them, I think, related to this, is one time a monk came to the Zen teacher Yunnan and said, I've heard it said in this treatise on the flower ornament sutra that it says the fundamental affliction of ignorance is itself the immutable knowledge of all Buddhas. And the treatise says, and this is most profound and difficult to understand. The fundamental affliction of ignorance is itself the immutable knowledge of all Buddhas. And so the monk asked Yunnan, what is this all about? And it says it's so difficult to understand. Can you help me with this? And Yunnan says, actually, it's really easy to understand. I'll show you. And there's this novice boy monk walking by as they're speaking. And he says, novice. And the boy turns his head, yes. And Yunnan says to his friend, gesturing towards the boy, is this not the immutable knowledge of all Buddhas? O monk, yes. Is this not the immutable knowledge of all Buddhas? Immediate, uncontrived response without any conceptual thinking or hesitation. Just, monk, yes? Is this not the immutable knowledge of all Buddhas? And then Yunnan asks this novice boy, what is your Buddha nature? And the boy says, bye, and he runs away. And Yunnan says to his friend, is this not the fundamental affliction of ignorance? So the same, very same person, one moment to another, perfectly pure Buddha response. Yes? And then, what is your Buddha nature? I don't know. I guess I need a good answer for the teacher, and I can't think of... I just got to get out of here. Now he's totally confused and caught up in conceptual thinking and self-concern, the fundamental affliction of ignorance. So each of us is like this, right? There's the immutable knowledge of all Buddhas when just the nature of mind resting as open space. And then as soon as self and other arise in that field of space, the fundamental affliction of ignorance is working. Hair's breadth deviation. It's a story about, oh monk, yes? Being the immutable knowledge of all Buddhas. And later, Keizan says in a commentary on a later ancestor, he says, "Don't you realize that when someone calls, you respond? And when someone points with a finger, you follow?" It's that way. Same idea, yeah? "This does not occur through discriminating judgment or through a conscious effort. It is the working of the host. This host has neither face nor bodily characteristics. However, he never stops moving." So, Keizan himself later says, when someone calls and we respond, that's the workings of the host. So in this case, Kashyapa says, "Ananda," and Ananda responds. It doesn't even say that he says yes. The literal story just says he responds. So there's like this call and response. A response comes forth from the host. The Buddha's teaching of his entire lifetime was just an appropriate response each moment. As for the matter of knocking down the flagpole, so he's going to, this is Keizan's interpretation of the flagpole, but before I read his, it's an interesting point, isn't it? It's almost like two different parts of the story. Ananda, yes. Almost like the story could end there. But then, Kashyapa says, take down the flagpole or the banner pole at the front of the gate. The flagpole or the banner pole. Knock it down or take it down. And so this is just my own thought about this because I found this sutra. That's kind of like a well-known sutra that's in the Pali canon of the simile of the snake sutra. Even Thich Nhat Hanh even has a translation because he feels like it's important. And in this sutra, the Buddha says, how is an enlightened one, a noble person whose banner is lowered, whose burden is lowered, and who is unfettered? So Buddha uses this image. And it's in this list of how is an enlightened person, like one who's cut the root, and he uses these different metaphors. But this paragraph, how is this one who understands the way, one whose banner is lowered? So he just uses this metaphor. And maybe it has nothing to do with this story, but I think it fits kind of nicely. One's banner is lowered. How is that? And the Buddha says, that one has abandoned the conceit, I am. The conceit of, quote, I am. The conceit of a separate self. Cut it off at the root so that it's no longer subject to future arising. One thus gone leaves no traces here and now. That's how an enlightened one is like one whose banner has been lowered. And he doesn't explain the metaphor further, but just the idea of like a banner or a flag. I mean, what is a flag in our culture, in every culture? A flag seems like it's like an identity, right? It's like a symbol for either a country, a business, a temple. I grew up sailing where, you know, flags on boats are all these symbols for different things. It's a symbol of your yacht club. It's private flags for your own family's boat. And it's like here I am, right? The colorful flag. And so lowering that flag of like the me, the individuality appearing in the world, just like lowering that. That's what he's going to talk about, yeah.
The Tibetan.
Yeah. Yeah.
The one who loves Tibetan.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Have you heard that from Zen, or did you hear in India too?
Or in probably not, because the debate actually started from 1 BCE, so there's a debate 300 years later after the story of the
I was reading the Cleary translation of that, and he mentions that specifically, that that was the custom, that the losing side would take down the flag. Yeah. And by taking down, and so I guess this was the remaining winning flag, and that went, and there's nothing left, you know?
Well, I could see that as a responding story. Something I think must be at play, because it is a competitive story.
Yeah, yeah, it was competitive, and then at the end, there was still one left, and then that went.
Yeah, but Alanda asked him the question.
Yeah. So I think we could take, well, I think when I first heard the story, but without reading the commentary, I thought of it more like the flag as some kind of, you know, carrying the self forward in the world and just like let go of, drop away, lower the flag is like drop off, you're carrying yourself forward. But another interpretation that another Zen teacher brings up is that there's a custom, I think in Japan, there's actually a custom of just putting up a banner or a flag when there's a Dharma event. Even at No Abode, they do that. Tenchin Roshi hangs the flag out on the days when there's a sitting there. Almost, it's like, and in Bukokuji, we would do that too. For special events, you'd hang flags on the front gate. And, yeah. Well, you know, I thought of making a sesshin sign for when people know that it's sesshin in the front or in the future. But, so we could just hear like, the flag of the Dharma talk, apart from even a debate, just a flag that a Dharma event is about to happen maybe. And, Ananda, yes. Okay, it's done. The Dharma talk's over. Take down the flag. So that would be like a second interpretation. The Dharma talk's finished. And the third is the one that Sho is bringing up, that Kazon also mentions, about the two flags of a debate. Kazon says, as for the matter of knocking down the flagpole in India, when the Buddha's disciples and other philosophers or practitioners of other traditions had a debate, both sides put up a flag. When one side was defeated in debate, their flag was taken down. Defeat was indicated without sounding drums and bells. In the present story also, it is as if Kashyapa and Ananda had lined up for debate and set up their flags. If Ananda wins, or another translation says, if Ananda is now appearing in the world as the second ancestor, Kashyapa should roll up his flag. One comes forth and the other disappears. So far, I can probably follow that, but now I have trouble following this next part. Kazon says, however, this is not the case in the present story. If Kashyapa and Ananda are flagpoles, the principle, like the true principle, in parentheses, the principle of the original face, is not revealed or is not evident. So if both Kashyapa and Ananda are flagpoles or have these flagpoles, the principle of the host or the original face is not revealed. When a flagpole is knocked down, a flagpole will be revealed, or a flagpole should be revealed.
Well, I think you're saying that when he holds down
Yeah.
You have to knock down the flagpole to be realized, so to speak, to see. So if they're both up, there's no wind, there's no letting go.
Yeah. Yeah, because in this transmission, there's no winner.
Yeah.
It's everybody lets go.
Yeah.
That's the...
But both should be down.
Yeah, both should be down. Mm-hmm.
Then that makes room for a new flagpole to appear, depending on conditions.
And what would the new flagpole be?
An appropriate response to the next situation.
That signal.
And then that would come down.
Which, almost like the flagpole is like... are you saying almost like the pre-awakened potential disciple is the next flagpole, and then they have to get knocked down too?
Yeah,
that could be it.
And isn't there a story about the Buddha appears when
in this future,
when the self goes away, or when non-concepts go away? There's something about entering that.
So the appearance of a Buddha.
Yeah.
Like a flag.
Yeah. Or that kind of wisdom space of body and mind. Then a Buddha appears. The absolute.
Yeah, we might even say in the Dharmakaya of dropping off everything, all flags lowered, then a Nirmanakaya flag appears in the world to help beings by waving in the wind.
Yeah.
Like, that's the kind of positive view of the flag, right? The Buddha flag.
Mm-hmm.
Or we could hear it as flags are basically always a problem. All flags must be lowered.
Signlessness.
Mm-hmm. Remove the signs. Yeah.
Dogen would say, what was transmitted?
Yes.
Signless what?
Yeah.
And it could have been appropriate just to Ananda, who was really caught up in signs and texts and had no intellectual.
Yeah.
And the flags fit the intellectual here.
Yeah.
Here's something I can point to.
Yeah.
So maybe for his understanding, you don't need any of that. Now start to be.
Yeah. Your huge flag is beautiful. And we needed it in this council. Now we have all the sutras. Now
you can
take it down. We have the stories of these Zen ancestors burning all the sutras, right? When they finally realized that ocean storehouse of sutras is like a drop of water in the vast ocean, like a hair in the space.
Were the sutras actually written down any time around the time of the
Buddha? Well, later.
Yeah.
Hundreds of years later.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
No, because it's India, it's monsoon, and everything's written on sugar material.
Yeah.
Seems like one classic story is that it was just an oral transmission, and people would memorize hundreds of pages of sutras and pass them on by memory orally till they were written. So also it's interesting that it's not just take down the flag, but the flag pole.
Yeah.
So, which I also think of as like in this image of the flag is like the outward identity, fully expressed in the world, and the pole is what holds it up, like maybe the subtle innate view of self, and the flag is like the expressed personality that's held up by this subtle unconscious view that there's somebody here. And so we need to take down the pole too.
Yeah, at first blush I heard the pole is like the body.
The body, and then the flag is like the expressions of the body in speech.
Yeah.
Because as they take down the flags, they take down the pole.
Yeah.
They don't really know what flag's on it. Right?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe even like, so if we took it like that, it could even say, Ananda is already an arhat. His flag is already taken down. But there's still this pole left. Yeah, the flag's come down already. And now, take down the pole in front of the gate. Gate to the host, maybe you could say. Yeah.
And what's the
blocking the gate?
Buddha is Buddha the fake, what do you call it?
The original
face. Uh-huh. Is that arhat or is that?
That's like
that's the Buddha seal.
That's right? The Buddha seal.
So that would be commensurate with no pole.
Yeah. I like that. Like. Arhatship is lowering the flag, just like in the Buddha's, in his Pali Sutra saying, and it's talking about an arhat here. How is an arhat one whose banner is lowered? He has abandoned the conceit of I am. So the arhat's lowered the banner or the flag, and now the Buddha's saying, now it's time to, knock down the pole, take down the pole. Yeah.
But the story puts it as though, like, there's a flag, and the flag's got to be taken down, or the pole's got to be taken down,
Well, that's, but that's why when Kashyapa heard take down the flagpole, he was instantly greatly awakened. In other words, he didn't have to do anything.
Yeah.
How am I, first I need a saw.
Right.
That's like a bulldozer.
Yeah, bulldozer. Take down the pole, kind of like, his awakening. The pole's down. Or we might even say, what pole? What pole? So, yeah?
Brian, did you want to say something? You notice I was quiet? I'm still confused about what arhat is. The arhat thing. I don't understand this arhat.
And what's the difference between the arhat and the Buddha?
And I don't understand that going to the keyhole. So. Why is it named the story?
I think with all these Indian ancestors in this book, Kazan, they get even weirder in terms of like. Magical things happening, and I think it's partly like entertainment. it's a colorful side of our tradition. I think that there is, and also Indian spiritual tradition in general. There's still all this. People are into like magical powers and stuff, and the Buddha was always made the point that that's not the point. So I think that's a nice thing about Buddha's teaching is he said, there are these powers actually, but the important one is to release greed, hate, and delusion. Mm-hmm. And you don't need these powers, but they're part of like the spiritual suitcase of tools or something.
They do have a function. I mean, there's this fact that to see life as a dream, in our mind, the way to say everything is emptiness, everything is like a dream. So if everything is like a dream, anything is possible. Like enterprise is home. That once you actually see everything is possible, you are manifesting everything is possible because everything is possible. So this kind of underlining everything is possible part comes out with this magical story that are actually in that particular culture in Asia. Very much appreciated.
Yeah.
You just came through a whole Abrahamic residue.
Yeah.
That's not so appreciated, right?
Mm.
So it alludes to possibility.
Hmm?
It alludes to possibility.
But they're shamans in these cities, these powers, mm-hmm. in India, and just about all primitive cultures.
Yeah, even the Abrahamic residue includes lots of walking on water and so on, right?
Yeah,
burning bushes and I think all spiritual traditions have parting the waters.
Yeah.
But I think that is a nice point of, like, for example, like being able to walk through a wall. It's like we really believe, like, on a, such a deep level that this is a solid wall and we can't walk through it. And that's just our normal view. But the more we open to things really aren't what they seem, it's not necessarily that we can suddenly walk through a wall, but things become more like...
fluid.
Fluid, yeah. And it's, I think it's, you could say, we can't fly and walk through walls because we really believe that that's not possible, because this is the way things are.
You set a mark, you don't go so far. But if you raise it so far, then possibility is everything. People much harder.
People can run a mile in a minute.
That's interesting, because of Victor's question about what's not ahard, and then the opposite is the Bodhisattva or Buddha. So the ahard and Buddha's awakening are same in essence, difference in
fear.
Like the
R
fear is said to be not as wise because it doesn't include all beings.
Field?
Field. Mm-hmm. Like the power. Like it's just a small field versus a Buddha fear
is
omniscience. Yeah. So omniscience is to know
everything that there is. In order to help in every possible way.
Yes.
Right. And I think that traditionally that's set up because you only know something vast and you can know something small, and that's why the whole discourse came out of this whole discussion in the early part of the tradition where all these people come out and say, I'm a heart. Everybody was able to, like, this is an art, you know, this, and then all these arts popped up and then they were like, no, awakening is really vast, so if you don't want to sit with a spark of a flintstone, you know, just with a small field, you got to set up something really large, and you can do that only if you say, this is small. Then the aha became...
So the Mahayana started criticizing the arhats. I mean, this is true, because in Theravada Buddhism, still, this is considered the highest goal. Even in modern times, is the arhat, yeah. They don't talk about becoming a Buddha or a Bodhisattva, right? And it's a wonderful goal, and it's not lacking compassion, actually. It's just that then the Mahayana tradition is this newly evolved thing in about the first or second century that was kind of like, had this wider, bigger view, bigger field, and because, to emphasize how big the field is, Then they took the highest attainment of Buddhism at the time of Arhat and said, actually, it goes beyond that. Mm-hmm. So it was a little bit like, not exactly political, although I think there was politics involved too, but to make the point of how vast.
Well, what would Theravadins say about Mahayana?
Some, you know, the really orthodox Theravadas say it's not even Buddhism. Yeah, or like the Mahayana Sutras, the Lotus Sutra and the Heart Sutra, the really orthodox Theravadins would say, they're not really Buddha Sutras. Even though they were all probably written down around the same time, the Pali Canon and the Mahayana Sutras, I think nowadays historians say they probably all came into writing around the first century.
B.C.?
But still the Theravadins would say, this is the word of Buddha, these sutras about the Arhat, and when the really cosmic sutras about infinite world systems in all directions, and the Dharmakaya manifesting as the Nirmanakaya, and teachings like this, are like, that was some later thing people made up. And Zen, too, you know, is part of that. So, you know, that's what I say, the really orthodox ones. But I think many modern Theravadins totally honor the Mahayana too. It's just, it's a different it's a different approach and a different vehicle.
When did the term Hinayana come in? And that's pretty well gone now because that's a downplay of the lesser vehicle as opposed to a grayer vehicle.
I think it's okay to use it as a Mahayana teaching about what's the lesser vehicle or smaller vehicle. But as long as we don't mean by Hinayana, we don't mean the Theravada school. It's an invention by Mahayana in a way, right? To make a Mahayana point. Yeah, so it's talking, and you know, you can see why people do associate it with Theravada because it's about the arhats as kind of not really like the full range of what's possible. So, yeah. This is all part of this complex world of Buddha Dharma with different emphases and approaches, you know. And then you get like the Vajrayana, you put it on top of that, and they say, well, the Mahayana is not really quite complete, right? Everyone's continuously trying to go beyond, which is great as long as it doesn't get confused with speaking of others' faults. So with all this in mind, now here's this part, maybe this will make more sense now. In the present story, Keizan says, it's as if Kashyapa and Ananda had lined up for debate and set up their flags. If Ananda wins or now appears in the world, Kashyapa should roll up his flag. One comes forth and the other disappears. But then Keizan says, however, this is not the case in the present story. So maybe that's an idea that you could have, and he's saying it's not like that. If Kashyapa and Ananda are flagpoles, the principle of the original phase is not revealed. So I think this is kind of where we collectively came to, is that all flags must be lowered, right? If those two are flagpoles, the original face is not revealed. But then, Keizan says, when a flagpole is knocked down, a flagpole will be revealed, or should be revealed. That line, I think, is almost like a koan he can leave us with. But they're both flagpoles, the original face is not revealed. When a flagpole is knocked down, a flagpole should be revealed. I think that's a good one. Yeah.
The appearance of an appropriate response.
Yeah. All flagpoles are knocked down, but when a flagpole is knocked down, a flagpole is revealed. It's like, the unity of the two truths. Okay. When Kashyapa instructed Ananda to knock down the flagpole, Ananda was greatly awakened because teacher and disciple had become one in the way. After this great awakening, Kashyapa was also knocked down. And mountains and rivers were also all demolished.
Yeah, I thought that too. Mm-hmm.
Mountain becomes a
mountain
again.
Mm-hmm. Yes, right, yeah.
So this is gonna play out here a little bit, this point. First, mountains and rivers were all demolished and knocked down along with Kashyapa. As a result, the Buddha robe spontaneously came down over Ananda's head. However, this is, I think, this point about that Ken and Jeff are bringing up. However, you should not stop at standing like a 10,000-foot cliff in this lump of red flesh. Do not get stuck in purity. So I think this image of the 10,000-foot cliff is in this lump of red flesh is like there's this host. There's another name for the host, I think, is the 10,000-foot impenetrable cliff, you know, inside this appearing lump of red flesh called this body. I think the 10,000-foot cliff is like, you know, ineffable wall of suchness. It's just provocative Zen images, right? They're so weird. But I hear it not as like a solid self, but I hear it as this like, the gateless barrier, right? This like, yeah, it's a positive thing. I hear it as a it's used elsewhere here too as a kind of like steep, steep, unclimbable cliff that like you can't get a hold of. If you try to climb it, you just slide it down. But it's not really something. It's just the ineffable. Like the Batman hole. Yeah. Because he says, don't stop at standing like a 10,000 foot cliff in this lump of red flesh. Do not get stuck in purity. So I think that would be like at the emptiness of side of things. You should go further and understand the existence of the echo or the valley spirit. Which, remember, that's referring to Ananda's yes, the response, right? The response, like a valley spirit, like an echo, a natural, uncontrived response. That's not the purity of 10,000-foot cliff that is unmoving and impenetrable. This is the liveliness of coming forth in compassion. Yeah. Yes, this could be great compassion. Do not get stuck in purity. You should go further and understand the existence of the echo or the valley spirit. All Buddhas have appeared one after another in the world, and ancestral teachers have indicated it generation after generation. There is only this. Mind is transmitted by mind, but no one understands this at all. Even though the revealed lumps of red flesh, Kashyapa and Ananda, they're the revealed lumps of red flesh, like all of us. Even though the revealed lumps of red flesh, called Kashyapa and Ananda, are that one, capital T, capital O, the host, are that one revealed in the world as one or two faces, do not think that Kashyapa and Ananda alone are that one. You people right now are each the 10,000-foot cliff, the 1,000 changes and 10,000 transformations of that one. If you understand that one, you will all disappear at once. If that is so, do not look for the knocked-down flagpole outside of yourselves. Today, this descendant of Daijo, which means Mahayana, descendant of Keizan, Keizan is the successor of Tetsu Gikai, would also like to add a few words. Would you like to hear them? Vines withered, trees fallen, mountains crumbled, valley streams gush forth, and sparks fly out from stones. We dedicate any merit generated in our transmission of light assembly this week to tens of thousands of lumps of red flesh across this world system and all world systems. May the lumps enjoy the display of this magical world and realize the host within. Beings are numberless. I vow to to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.